Today on Maine Calling, Wapanaki artifacts and remains finally come home. Recently, two New England museums, the Abbey Museum and the Haffenraffer Museum of Anthropology at Brown University, announced plans to return sacred cultural items to Wapanaki tribes. For the Abbey, it is the second time in the past 5 years that experts have identified Wapanaki artifacts and remains to return. Most of these items were stolen more than a century ago. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn more about the shameful history behind how so many museums have Native artifacts and the ongoing efforts to return them. The work of repatriation is often sensitive and difficult, and nationally, some museums have resisted, even though they are bound by federal law. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we're going to learn about the sensitive and important work of repatriation, that is, the return of cultural artifacts and remains to tribal people. The Wapanaki tribes are among those receiving sacred cultural items that have been in museums for a century or longer. Joining me for this conversation, Chris Sock-Alexis, who is Historic Preservation Officer for the Penobscot Nation, Aaron Miller, who is Curator of Exhibits and Collections for the Abbey Museum, and Mary Huditz, an investigative reporter for ProPublica, who won national awards for her work on the 2023 series, The Repatriation Project. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. And I want to start with you, Chris. Before we talk about the work of repatriation that I know you're so deeply involved in, let's talk about how these artifacts and remains were taken in the first place. The tribes did not sell them or trade them. They were stolen, and predominantly stolen from graves, correct? When did this happen? What years? And what do we know about who took these items?
Yeah, so, excuse me. Yeah, these items starting back in like the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, some were, were inadvertent discoveries at first. Some were in farm fields and whatnot. But then once they started getting more and more accessible, then really the looting did begin. Archaeologists back in the day were definitely going out looking for graves, for the grave goods, primarily, is in my opinion. Some burials were excavated to the point where they were split. Like, the human remains would go one place, the funerary objects, grave goods, would go to another institution. So they were just spread, you know, it was like spreading the wealth. So trying to repatriate those back has been somewhat of a challenge, to keep the individual ancestors with their funerary objects, you know, to bring them back together for reburial.
Did you, at the time in the 1910s, the 1920s, were your people aware of what was going on?
For the most part, I want to say yes. Here, on Indian Island, when they were building the roads, they did come across a red paint burial. And then it was from hearing the old, some of the elders talk, it was like a free for all. Like, people were coming in, just taking what they could. And again, another inadvertent discovery that just got out of control.
My God.
So yeah, I do believe the Wabanaki communities were aware of what was happening. Maybe down along the coast, not so much, but definitely within reservation lands, yes.
Aaron, how did the items that the Ma Abbey Museum has or has had come to be at the Abbey Museum, and how did they come to other museums for that matter?
Yeah, so thanks for having me. The Abbey Museum, like many collecting institutions in this country in the West, it was founded by a wealthy white man who was interested in the more ancient history of the area. And so, when the Abbey began, it was really focused on the archaeology. And Robert Abbey, he was acquiring objects from what Chris was talking about, like a lot of these, say some of were more formal archaeologists, but they were doing the same work. They were digging burials. They were like there are all sorts of ways. Pot hunters were acquiring things and then sending them to museums like this. And so over the years, the Abbey has shifted to be an institution that talks about the ancient history of this place, but is really focused on the living cultures. But I think in the past there was really kind of this disconnect from the people who were here 1,000, 2,000 plus years ago with the current community. So for much of its history, the focus was on what was left behind. And there are lots of paths that items come to museums, and it's I think we can talk more about that as you want to get into the specifics about repatriation. But it's really is collectors, it was pot hunters, it was people walking on the beach finding things that were eroding out. So lots of different paths.
Mary, in 1990, Congress passed a law that is referred to by its acronym NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. It mandated that museums return Native artifacts to the people they were taken from. Your investigation in 2023, more than 30 years after the law was passed, found that many major museums were not fulfilling their obligations under the NAGPRA law. Can you talk about the scope of this dereliction? I mean, we're talking about museums all over the country, right? And thousands of artifacts and even human remains.
The scope was astounding. That was probably the entry point for our investigation, which was a many multi-part series, looking at different examples of resistance or struggles around repatriation over the last more than 30 years. But yes, NAGPRA, our Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, was a response to this history that had been completely, that Chris and Aaron just discussed, like had been completely sort of unknown maybe to a lot of the public and also largely unaddressed. And the idea when Congress passed it was that the number, like that perhaps, at least in the records we saw, that maybe by passing this law in 10 years, repatriations would have been sort of finished. And then to enter the investigation 30 years later and find at the start of the investigation that more than 100,000 ancestors were still yet to be repatriated, and that was more than half that was initially recorded in the records. And then many, many hundreds more thousands of items. So we wanted to know, of course, not just the number, but the stories behind why, and to try to tell the more human aspect of the story and why it matters to the people who are trying to reclaim what was taken. And so that led us down some like really interesting paths, and we spent more than a year working on it, but I know that we could have, there were many more stories to tell.
And what was their excuse? Why weren't museums following the federal law in returning these items?
There was a range, I think, of reasons. One, I mean, I I think there are many, like we're talking 600, more than 600 museums across the country that reported holding human remains. And some of them are very small institutions that I think in some cases legitimately, like the cost and sort of the complications around the law could be tough for them to overcome without assistance. But then there's also extremely large institutions like Harvard University and UC Berkeley in California that had massive collections and had not really, when we started reporting, or at least relatively, had not made significant headway in returning what they had. Some of the reasons would that they would present would be that one, a tribe didn't come forward to claim what was taken, or that they just couldn't connect. Their academics couldn't were not willing to say that, ancestors taken from a particular gravesite could definitively be the
The actual
connected.
ancestors. Yeah. And Chris, you dealt with some of this, right? You dealt with people saying, well, that was the red paint people, right? I mean, tell us about that kind of resistance that you have experienced in the past.
I call it like the old school of thinking of archaeology, where they really tried to disconnect, modern day Wabanaki people with our ancestors. Some will stress that, the red paint people and the Susquehanna, were peoples that moved and left, and then us modern day Wabanakis moved in after everything was said and done. When, we're sitting here on Indian Island, which is one of our burial islands, that we've never been removed from our homelands. So I strongly believe that, we are the red paint people of Maine. We've been here for thousands of years, millennia, and we're still here today, and we still do the red paint ceremonies today.
Mary, I know that the Department of Interior updated and strengthened NAGPRA at the end of 2023. Do you think that was as a result of your reporting?
No, I would struggle to say that's the case. I knew that that work was afoot for many, many years. Of course, it went over the finish line in the year that we were doing that work, but huge years-long effort by people who've been doing this work for decades to get those new regulations in effect, which was supposed, I think in large part, at least in the first year, like I haven't revisited the data, but had resulted in quite a few repatriations.
Well, I'll ask you that, Chris. Since the law was strengthened at the end of 2023, did you see a surge of museums coming forward and contacting you and maybe getting serious in a way that they hadn't before?
Yeah, most definitely. We're currently, when the notice did come out, the updated NAGPRA law, we did get a lot of inquiries about vetting collections. So we're in the process of that, doing that now, where whole wings of museum space was closed down, just so the tribes and nations from across the country could vet what each museum has in their collections. And so we're still in the process of doing that. Vetting what they do have in collections compared to what can actually be repatriated.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, there's certain objects that were, throughout the years that were bought, baskets and whatnots. But as far as the ancestors go, it's definitely, they need to be returned home.
Aaron, how does the Abbey identify the items that need to be repatriated? Where do you even start?
Yeah, so I've only been to the Abbey for 2 years, so I've done a certain amount of work. I mean, so much of the NAGPRA related work was done here in the 1990s. I think it's
So the
depending
Abbey
on.
was one of the museums that took it seriously in the first place and did work early. Okay, go on.
It was. I think over the years things have happened in very different ways. Bringing in consultants from the communities, like working closely with them to identify. I mean, in some cases, the records clearly show that items were burial belongings. So, you know, with some of the work, it's very straightforward. You know, I think, you know, talking about the scale of institutions, sometimes the challenge can be, you know, having devoted people within a museum. I mean, the Abbey's focus is really solely on the Wabanaki Nation. So of course that's a priority here, but you know, I think there were ancestors that were repatriated in the 1990s. So that work clearly was happening you know, soon after the legislation was put into place. You know, more recently there were almost 1,000 burial belongings that were returned, and that work was done, you know, I think, you know, with many consultants, but you know, bringing in experts from the communities to help identify. So some case the records, some case getting the right eyes on things.
Mm-hmm. And I know that for you this is very important, but also very sensitive work.
Yeah, I mean, it's over the years at other, you know, institutions I've been at, kind of come to realize that like this is difficult work for, of course, on the community end, and it's difficult work on the museum side as well. Just trying to make sure that we're talking with the right folks and doing things in the way that the federal legislation's laid out. But you know, of all the work that I've done in museums, it's the most important, because it's about, you know, sort of righting wrongs, returning, you know, people to their communities.
Mary, one of the articles you co-wrote focused on Harvard University and Wabanaki remains and artifacts. You mentioned Harvard earlier. Tell us about what happened at Harvard. It's a different story than the Abbey Museum, isn't it?
Yeah. I thought this piece, like I said, I think we wrote 7 or more stories that year that were quite lengthy. But this one was definitely one of our most important, and one I was pretty eager to tell once we had permission from an engagement from the Wabanaki committee to do so. But I think as Chris had mentioned, there was this history of excavation in Maine and like a deep interest in the more ancient history of the area. So our story looked specifically at a set that researchers at Harvard over the years had very much coveted. And also this collection, for lack of a better word, was split between Harvard and another smaller institution, as Chris had also described, can be the case sometimes. We thought this story was remarkable for a few reasons. I had mentioned earlier that one of the things that institutions often say, very large ones, is that tribes are not coming forward to claim ancestors. But in the records that we had been able to obtain pretty early on, we could see, once we organized them and put them in chronological order to understand them better, like that there was a clear record of the Wabanaki tribes going to Harvard again and again over the course of 30 years, the life of the law, essentially, that demanded repatriations to get the ancestors back. And that, I think, helped us tell a story that had been, I think, before that reporting, had been really difficult, probably for all journalists, to really document and tell.
Good for you for doing that hard work. Chris, in the couple of years since Mary's story ran and since this was revealed, has Harvard changed its stance?
I believe so. You know, in 2020, 2021, excuse me, when we went down to repatriate a lot of ancestors. They actually reached back out to us saying, we found some more ancestors. So they actually reached back out to us and saying, we've discovered more in our collections. And we will be, we're in the process of repatriating those newfound ancestors as well.
So much more to ask you all, but we do need to go to a break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about repatriation of Wabanaki remains and artifacts that are in museums across the Northeast and in other parts of the country as well. What are your questions? The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about the history behind the desecration of tribal grave sites and the efforts, repatriation efforts to return them. Joining me, Mary Huditz, who is ProPublica's a reporter with ProPublica, who was one of the main reporters on a big project called the Repatriation Project. She's also a member of the Crow Tribe. Chris Sakalexis is the Penobscot Nation's Historic Preservation Officer, and Aaron Miller, curator with the Abbey Museum. We invite you to join the conversation, wondering if you have seen Wabanaki artifacts displayed in museums or maybe even local historical societies, and maybe you have something yourself that you'd like to ask our experts about. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And I'm wondering, Chris, how often does someone call you and say, you know, my grandfather died and I have this collection of arrowheads or bones and I want to bring them to you? I mean, does this happen?
More often than you'd expect, especially with my office up here. We do, you know, we do get people calling in saying, hey, you know, our family's had this for years and we don't know what to do with it. We don't want to sell it. We don't want to, you know, we want to return it to the proper tribal communities. Actually just went to South Berwick a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, it was about a month ago. This family lost their father, and he had a lot of artifacts from Maine that they wanted to return to the tribe. So I went down and brought those home from a private collection. But yeah, private collectors do reach out quite often to bring stuff home.
And Aaron, I see you nodding. Does the museum encounter this as well? Does the Abbey?
Yeah, I would say a few times every month, you know, someone will reach out with a collection of material, and you know, our collections committee, it's always made up of a majority of Wabanaki people. So, you know, there's a connection to Chris and then the other TIPOs from Maine. So people are kind of aware of what's
TIPO
happening.
TIPO is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer.
Yes.
Yeah, go on.
You know, there's a real interest to make sure that these materials don't just end up, you know, in the market or, you know, in the trash. So yeah, it's pretty extraordinary when you start realizing just how much material is out there that has been, you know, taken off the beach or out of the ground. And again, you know, the conversation today is like where all these things end up, and, you know, really across the country and across the world. So it's, you know, it's not just ancestral remains and burial belongings. It's also, you know, some of the more everyday materials, but, you know, important things that, yeah, they're turning up all the time.
You said, Aaron, that you want to keep it out of the market. Is it legal to buy and sell these artifacts?
Yeah. So it's, I think for the most part, when you're not talking about ancestral remains, like if, say, if you're talking about burial objects, you see a lot that's on the market. And I think, I don't, you know, NAGPRA does not apply to private collections. So I think that is the case with a lot of these sensitive materials.
We'll go to Maimon, who's calling from Sebago. Hi, Maimon, go ahead.
Hi, I have a couple of questions and thank you for taking my call. I love the show. Can DNA testing be applied for identifying remains, and should museums be required to pay for that? And secondarily, why aren't museums required to reach out to the tribes rather than the burden being on the tribes, like with a list of their artifacts, so the tribe can then respond to them since they have the list. Why are the tribes required to reach out to the museums?
Yeah, Maimon, thanks so much for those questions. I'll go back to you, Aaron.
So the second part of the question, so museums that have taken federal funding directly or indirectly are required to reach directly out to the communities that they represent. So that is on the museums. Doesn't always happen, though.
Mm-hmm. And what about, are you using DNA or is that just too expensive and not necessary? Chris?
Well, DNA testing is destructive, for one, and we really do not want to have that happen. You know, we want as much as our ancestral remains returned. And again, it's a destructive process. And we've had a number of questions about that is, why don't you do DNA to prove your affiliation? And we don't have to. We already know we're affiliated with our ancestors.
Hmm. Maimon, thank you for your questions. Here's an email from Carl. I grew up on a farm in the Royal River Valley in New Gloucester. 50 years ago, I was riding on the back of our farm tractor that my older brother was pulling manure spreader to a field. Looking down in the farm road, I noticed a 10-inch long stone tree chopping axe or hoe, depending what expert you talk to. The farm tractor and equipment had run over it hundreds of times, but it was still in great shape because it's made of stone after all. All my kids have moved out of state. I have no remaining family members in northern New England. Ethically, should this artifact be given to the New Gloucester Historical Society, the State of Maine Historical Society, or to an existing Indian tribe that never lived in the Royal River Valley? To my knowledge, none of the four existing Maine tribes lived in northern Cumberland County. So who wants to answer Carl's question?
I can jump in on one point. I'm not an expert on who lived where, but part of our project on repatriation was publishing a map of where excavations happened. We didn't go deeply detailed because we don't want to show where a burial was, but at a county level, and you can easily look at that map on ProPublica.org to get a sense of which tribes claim connection to different areas, even if they've, like, for example, in the Midwest, been during relocation, moved westward. But I think that's there are other experts on the line who can better answer more.
And thank you for doing that, Mary. And Chris, and correct me if I'm wrong, even if Mary's map doesn't show something specific, a certain peoples for Northern Cumberland County, isn't it true that throughout history, the Wabanaki people moved throughout this, what is now the state of Maine, during different seasons to do different things, different harvesting and such?
Yeah, definitely seasonal movement was occurring. But with Southern Maine, a lot of the bands of people, indigenous people living there, you know, once became more and more European populated, they moved, you know, a lot down in that area, probably went up into Quebec or up into Northern Maine as well. But there were numerous bands of tribal people living within Southern Maine.
Mm. And it's interesting to me because our emailer mentioned that this piece of stone is either a chopping axe or a hoe. And Chris, I know that you would be personally very interested in seeing that, correct?
I would actually, yeah. I'm always interested in see someone's private collections and findings, you know. And the big thing with that and with the whole repatriation as well is, you know, I look at it as, you know, if someone wants to return items back to the tribal communities, you know, it's meant to be, you know, we're supposed to have these things back in our possession. I always think that when we repatriate artifacts back, it gives us an opportunity to relearn an ancient technique, an ancient, when I flint knap, I call it the art of stone tool making. So it's an art form to me as well as utilitarian pieces. But they come back for a reason, you know, and to relearn our old ways is how I look at it, to relearn how to, I look at pieces that when they're returned, I often try to replicate them You know, doing the flint knapping, the making stone tools. You know, I really try to look at the piece and see what techniques were used to make that certain piece. That's an interest of mine.
Yeah. Mary, you wrote a piece about what it was like as an Indigenous person to report and write this series. It was very moving, and I hesitate to bring it up because you talk about the trauma of doing this story and doing these stories. And I think it's a really important perspective for those of us who are not Indigenous people to understand that this is very, very painful.
Yeah, you know, I think I had grown up, I think first of all, every tribe is different. Like they're the way they talk about or think about or have relationship with items that are in museums. And I don't know, like, if this is our tradition, but I just had grown up feeling that it was like a, such a sensitive topic to talk about and to even broach. And so to report on this subject generally was a big decision. And I'm glad that we took the approach we did instead of just a quick story that maybe didn't do full service to the project. We really were able to dig in with like art to investigate with a full team and have like the time and the space to really like think about points of sensitivity. And I would say that the thing that had helped though, because I think, sorry, just sort of jumping ahead of myself, but with the trauma specifically, I think it's important to remember that these excavations, especially maybe where I'm from, I can speak to where I'm from in the West, happened at a time when there was already so much upheaval and violence and colonization was happening and displacement of Native people. And that's why sometimes tribes are not able to claim certain ancestors or run up against roadblocks because they were displaced from the place where the burials had been. They were displaced by the government. And so I think you kind of, all of that difficulty can sort of intersect into the topic of repatriation, and then put on top of that, that we have like such, you know, all cultures I think have respect for the deceased, but I think there is a special and different way about, I think, a way a lot of Native or Indigenous cultures respect their ancestors. And so to have them removed and taken to museums and to have the DNA, which is, you know, that DNA was asked about earlier, but that is destructive, as was mentioned, and is a whole nother sort of road to go down. But I think that adds to the trauma. But I think the thing that actually helped also with reporting these stories was talking to people who were tribal historic preservation officers and talking to people who had, you know, I think in this particular story, you know, Donna Augustine, who works with the Wabanaki community, and then, you know, Daryl Newell, like hearing them talk about it with me. I had also interviewed tribes out here in New Mexico where I live now, or the Southwest. And there was a man on the Hopi reservation who I called at the start of our reporting, and he discussed the trauma, talked to him a year later, still doing the reporting, and it was the same conversation. So this issue like really stays with people, but understanding how I think people who do have done the work for decades, who are traditional, who are elders in the way they could talk about how they take care of themselves or how they process it, I think helped me process this issue as well as a reporter, which is helpful.
Hmm. Mary, you mentioned Daryl Newell. We were hoping he could call in today, but he'd be traveling. And so he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to. Chris, when you listen to what Mary says, does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it does. You know, it's heartbreaking that, you know, these archaeologists in the past were just doing this. They were just going into burial sites and again, like I said earlier, just looting, you know, for the objects, for the trophies, you know, so to speak, is how I kind of call them in their eyes. But it is. And it's a real good celebratory feeling when you do get ancestors home. You know, they've been in a box for years and years and years, and to have them come home and be reburied, you know, the ceremonies that go along with it, it's a celebration, you know, that we're actually bringing our ancestors home and treating them properly and not having them stored in a box in a basement.
I want to hear more about the ceremony, if that's all right, but we do have to take another quick break. We're talking about repatriation on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about the repatriation of Wabanaki cultural artifacts and remains, part of a national effort to bring ancestors home to tribes across the country. With me today, Chris Sakalexis with the Penobscot Nation, Aaron Miller with the Abbey Museum, and Mary Huditz with ProPublica. Share your comments and questions. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. And Chris, I'm going to turn back to you. I was talking to Daryl Newell on the phone a little bit about 35 years ago, when NAGPRA was first passed, and how he and other TIPOs had to figure out what to do. You know, now that these remains and these artifacts are coming back, how do we treat them with dignity and ceremony? And I'm wondering if you can explain at least what the Penobscot Nation does when you finally get some of these artifacts and remains back.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into full detail about the ceremonies, as they're private for each community. But when they do come home, you know, we do have ceremonies, you know, welcome home ceremonies. Generally speaking, you know, we'll have a feast and a sacred fire. And then a lot of prayers will go into the reburial process.
Yeah. Aaron, on your end, in the museum end, is there special, is there a way of transferring these items? How do you think about doing this with dignity and respect?
Yeah, so we really try to collaborate closely with the communities that they're going back to. And I think each community wants the care taken in different ways. You know, I think you talk about dignity and respect. You know, we always try, like, as these conversations are happening, to make sure that ancestors, their belongings are in appropriate spaces. You know, they're kind of treated with kind of appropriate materials, you know, wrapping them. Sometimes medicines from the communities are part of it. And they're, you know, over the years, I've worked with people from different communities, and you know, we really try to make their ancestors, the belongings, accessible. So, you know, sometimes people will come in as the process is continuing and just let them know that they're loved and that, you know, they're coming. So, you know, I think, again, it's really reaching out, listening, and, you know, really making the best of a situation that, you know, shouldn't have happened in the first place, but you know, it's important that it's happening now. And I, you know, I want to really put it out there that, you know, this work is never done on the museum side. You know, I've talked to people that, oh, we're finished with NAGPRA, but you know, just like the Abbey with these recent repatriations, you know, as more people see things, as the law changes, as the perceptions from the communities about what are sacred objects, what's cultural patrimony changes, so that this work is going to continue well into the future.
Yeah, that was, you read my mind. I was going to ask you, even though the Abbey has made a really concerted effort for more than 30 years, still finding items, and that's, you know, kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Well, you know, going back to our earlier conversation about how how these materials were really shared across the country, across the world. Things turn up. There were loans that happened before records were taken. So suddenly things come back to the institution. In some cases, ancestors are represented by very small fragments. So, as more materials looked at, and I think it's important that research is happening in ways that's sanctioned by the communities as well. That the research that happens with archaeological collections also does lead to the return of ancestors.
Mary, I was going to ask you that. You mentioned that when you did the project in 2023, I thought it was thousands, but more than 100,000 remains in in other items in museums across the country. Where do we have any sense of where we are today? How much more needs to be returned?
So I think I had mentioned that earlier in the call that when we started reporting, there were more than 100,000 ancestors not returned, and that more than half had not yet been repatriated 30 years after the passage of the law. Now, in the year, or I think toward the end of the year of when we did our reporting, the National Park Service, which keeps this data, was able to say that museums had collectively passed the halfway mark, which felt like a big deal. But there's still 90,000 ancestors today who are in museums and still need to go through the repatriation process. So it's significant.
A huge number of people.
Mm-hmm. And that's based on data from the very start of this year.
Chris, how many museums are you working with? I can imagine as a tribal historic preservation officer, at times it might seem kind of overwhelming.
It is at some point when the new updated regs come out for NAGPRA, Penobscot Nation reached out to roughly 60 museums across the country that we know that they have Penobscot ancestors. And so we're slowly getting notices back from some of those universities, some of the closer ones that we put notifications out to, especially within New England and the Northeast, have responded. And we are in the process of repatriating ancestral human remains in the funerary objects.
So that's a lot of travel for you.
Not for me personally, but I occasionally I will go out and go on some of these longer trips. But for the most part, they're sending us their catalogs, which includes photographs, not of human remains, but of artifacts and baskets and what they think falls under NAGPRA. And again, a lot of the stuff may not, especially in the catalog record saying this was bought in 1920. This was purchased by a tribal member, at a certain date. But there are some diagnostic traits and artifacts that, as Aaron can attest to as well, as archaeologists, you notice. You'd be like, that gouge looks important. You know what I mean? Just the diagnostic traits of the artifacts themselves can denote the importance of, especially with the red paint artifacts, is you see the red ochre on the artifacts and they're from a burial. Other utilitarian items like gouges and axe heads and stuff, it's hard to tell if they are grave goods or not. Quite a few of these artifacts locally here are found within the Penobscot River, and it's hardly a day that I could go paddle and walk around on the shoreline and not find an artifact.
Aaron, I'm wondering if you can just talk about the change in attitude in archaeology generally, because we're having this conversation about repatriating Wabanaki remains and artifacts, but there's also a huge conversation going on around the world where major museums are returning things to places like Egypt. Where are we in this sort of global reckoning about what's in museums and why?
Yeah, I think I think within what's the United States, Canada, when it comes to archaeology that's being conducted by non-Indigenous people, more and more you see collaboration happening. Permission, the research questions are being defined more and more by kind of those First Nations. I think that, the field of archaeology, really across the world, there's much more acknowledgement that Indigenous communities need to be part of it. I mean, I think, with the Abbey in particular, for many years, the Abbey sponsored field work. But we've moved away from that. We've moved more towards a caretaking role when it comes to archaeology. So much has been extracted over the years, but being at other museums, you definitely see, particularly I think colleges, universities, they're looking at NAGPRA and then now looking beyond. I mean, there's some UNESCO legislation in place for objects from other communities, but I think more and more institutions are looking beyond the law. They're trying to think more about what's right, what's ethical. I'm hopeful that the conversations will continue in that way in the future.
Yeah. Do you think in the future, 20 years from now, we're going to go to museums like, the Met or the British National Museum and not see the things that we can see today?
I think Mary? To some regard, that's already started to happen. In January of 2024, once these new regulations we're talking about went into effect, a lot of, at least museums governed by NAGPRA, by the federal law, which, those are just museums that accepted federal money. Those are the ones that have to follow this law. Part of these regulations was for them to be in better consultation with tribes about what goes on display in museums, because sometimes funerary items were, grave items were on display, or something that was particularly sacred to a tribe that, shouldn't, really should maybe only be out at certain times, could be on display. And so they had to consult the Field Museum. I think most remarkable, I just always remember them because of the visuals, but had put basically butcher paper taped over their cases in their Native American exhibit. And then I think the American Museum of Natural History in New York closed off a part of their exhibit for quite a time. So that has happened. I think, I don't know now where things stand, what may have gone back out on display and what didn't, but that has been something
and
that has
we're
happened.
Talking about NAGPRA, which is a federal law that applies to museums that take federal funding. But Chris, Maine, for example, is sprinkled with small historical societies. And if it's not the law, do you believe it is within their ethical duty to contact you if they have something that is likely a Wabanaki, either remain or artifact?
Yeah, I've visited a number of historical societies throughout the state over the last 10, 15 years, more intensely. But there are some local historical societies within Penobscot-Hancock County that are showcasing in their cases red paint burial items, the tools, the red ochre itself in jars. I've seen it firsthand and talked to the people, the townsfolk there. It's tough because they don't have that federal funding, so they're not required. But ethically, yes, they should be reaching out to the tribal communities for repatriation. A couple of them I am talking to, most recently are looking into returning some of those items back to the Wabanaki tribes, which is a good thing. But others, they really want to hang on to them because it's their town history. And I met a lady at one of the historical societies down along the coast, where the artifacts and the red ochre came out of her family's farm. And you know, back in the day, and you know, she's really adamant about keeping them within the historical society, within the town's history. And again, that's hard, and it all comes down to that ownership factor, like museums have. You know, we own this now.
Well, I would like to keep going on, but we're out of time. Thank you so much. That was Chris Sokolexis, Historic Preservation Officer for the Penobscot Nation. Also with us for the hour, Mary Huditz, a reporter for ProPublica and a member of the Crow Tribe, and Aaron Miller, curator of exhibits and collections at the Appy Museum. This is Maine Public Radio.